Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Lob podcast from These Football Times. I'm Gary Thurker, and with the European Championships on the horizon, I'm chatting for half an hour or so with a number of members of the TFT team as they recount their memories of past championships, and we look forward together to the 2024 tournament. In this episode, it's a return journey down memory lane for Dr. David Turner, and we're going to be discussing another of his memories of Euros gone by. Welcome back, David.
Thank you, Gary.
Right, last time we discussed, we chatted about the England game against Croatia, the 4-2 triumph and Sven's best moment. This one, we're moving on a couple of years, to another great coach's great moment. Who are we going to talk about this time, mate?
So my memory is of the powerful, compelling story of Rinus Michels' double redemption at Euro 1988.
Brilliant. I mean, you know, it couldn't be further up my street if we tried. Memory lane, perfect for me, mate. So we're gonna have a great reminisce about this game. So give us a little bit of context. You say about redemption. So give us a little bit of context, David.
This is one of the greatest, most influential football coaches of all time. Michels, of course, led the Dutch national team in this tournament to their only silverware at the... And it still remains their only silverware internationally. With the redemption bit, along the way, they beat their old foes, West Germany, in the semi-final, managed by Beckenbauer, who had lifted the cup in 74 as captain when West Germany defeated Michels' magnificent total football Dutch team. They also defeated the Soviet Union in the final, who they'd lost 1-0 to in the first game of Euro 88. And again, to give a bit of context, that the Soviets were led by Valery Lobanovsky, another big beast of coaching, who similarly championed pressing and the interchange of positions as Michels did. Lobanovsky is the second most decorated manager of all time behind Ferguson and the most successful manager of the 20th century. Michels' Dutch team also won the final in Munich's Olympic Stadium, the scene of the 1974 lost World Cup final. And then finally, you've got the cherry on the cake. They closed out this Euro 88 tournament 2-0 with one of the greatest strikes in goal scoring history, the famous Van Basten volley.
I mean, this is great. This could be great. I'm going to really enjoy this. I said half an hour at the start of this. We may run over a little bit, frankly, as they said in Gone with the Wind. Who gives a damn? So obviously the you mentioned that the Dutch didn't start the tournament particularly well. Well, I said didn't start it well. They had started with a defeat against Lobanovsky's Soviet Union, heavily inspired by the Dynamo Kiev team. That he was so successful with, and it was, I think, Vasily Rats, I think, scored for,
yes.
And you know, having sort of the first game defeat in a tournament is always put you on a knife edge of elimination. No more mistakes allowed, are there?
Yeah, but I think it's an interesting effect on Michels, and it's interesting to think about this. We're a long way from the heyday of total football, and I don't think you can describe what Michels did with this team as total football. And he said that they lost that first game in terms of discipline and organisation and not being hardworking enough. And that sets the scene for how his team plays. You know, it's a very hard-working Dutch team. It's not necessarily about the flair bit. You know, they've got some charismatic players, but there's a lot of workhorses in there. So it sets the scene for how Michels goes about transforming them and goes about closing things out pragmatically, which doesn't seem very Dutch.
It's fascinating. They go into the tournament. Obviously, the star striker with probably, if not the, certainly one of the top strikers in Europe, Van Basten, had been had an injury-ravaged season with Milan. And Bosman, who Ajax supporter, replaced Van Basten, played throughout the qualifiers and scored a handful of goals. I think he scored something like four or five in a game against Luxembourg, which didn't actually count because there was a... The game to be replayed after a smoke bomb was felled the Luxembourg goalkeeper. But Bosman played the first game. But after that defeat, obviously, Michels decided that he couldn't do without Van Basten, and that guy paid dividends, didn't he?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Bosman was the star of the qualifying. As we say, Van Basten started on the bench. I think he came on late in the first game. but he'd been plagued by injury. He'd had a series of ankle injuries. Ankle injuries are the most reoccurring injury, as I understand it. They affect your balance as well, so you re-injure yourself. So although Van Basten ends up being the top scorer of the tournament, he wears number 12 throughout. So he's expected to be the number 12. And it's one of the brave decisions that Mikkels makes in this tournament that really pay off.
Yeah, definitely. I know we're going to talk about the final. We're just going to briefly just skip through the group games, because after the defeat to the Soviet Union, they came up against Bobby Robson's England.
And then Van Basten, of course, scores a hat-trick. Not a spectacular hat-trick, but an efficient hat-trick. Was it Tony Adams he turns?
Yeah, Tony Adams came in later. A very young Tony Adams, and he got taught a few lessons.
Yeah, it wasn't the most technically excellent turn in the world. It was a fairly slow turn, but he still managed to make him look very good for the goal, yeah.
Yeah, and then they moved on to play the Republic, and this is Jack Charlton's Republic, and they had McGrath and I think McCarthy playing the centre-back. And in the second half, I mean, the Dutch needed to win, obviously, because they'd lost the first game. I think a draw would have put Ireland through.
Yeah, that's right. They were very, very late on in the game.
Yeah, it was a weird
going out.
Yeah, I think it was Vin Keast scored.
And it was a freak goal.
Yeah.
I think it's Ronald Koeman takes a shot that's really scuffed. It's incredibly scuffed. It manages to hit, is it Kaif? Did you say it? Kaif's head. But it imparts a spin on the ball.
Correct.
It looks like it's going wide and it spins in. So, where the Dutch perhaps didn't have luck in the past, they had luck in this tournament, and that's one of the lucky moments for them.
And if listeners have seen this or get a YouTube, have a quick look at the YouTube, because as David said, it's like an off break when it bounces and poor Paki Bonner in goal, who's kept goal brilliantly throughout the game, is absolutely left stranded, and the Dutch qualify. And, you know, as you mentioned, you know, throughout the tournaments in the past, Dutch on bad luck has sort of plagued them, but they had the break in this game, and then they went on to progress further.
The great game against West Germany. So their semi-final, they played West Germany in the semi-final. If you think about the significance of that game, then apparently more than half the Dutch population watched that game. It was the first win over West Germany that they'd had since 1956, I think it was, 32
correct.
Years. It triggered the biggest Dutch street parties since liberation at the end of World War II. So, you know, this is of national significance. It was a big revenge for the 74 loss in the final at the World Cup. Van Breukelen, the goalkeeper, said he'd been waiting for that moment for 14 years. And he also said that it was a gift to the older generation who'd lived through the war. And I'm drawing upon your own work there, Gary. I think I've just finished reading Dutch Masters, and I think that was in there. You write really nicely about Euro 88. Halfway through the game, the Dutch started chanting, "Give us our bicycles back."
Correct. Yeah,
this was about the requisition of the bikes during the German occupation in World War II. Now, it was 40 years before that, in 88, but they're still remembering that sort of thing. After the game, Koeman mimes wiping his backside with Olaf Ton's swap shirt to the crowd. After the final win, after they won the whole thing, a million people lined Amsterdam's canals as the trophy was paraded on a barge, and houseboats sank under the weight of people dancing on the roofs.
Classic. I mean, I remember, I think it's in David Winner's wonderful book, Brilliant Orange, that's one of the celebrations. They were all the Dutch were outside waving the bicycles in the air because of the, as you mentioned, I mean, a classic classic game. And you mentioned Van Breukelen, he saved a penalty in the game, which could have turned the game. And he was played for PSV, and they beat Benfica on penalties to win the European Cup a little earlier. And there was a famous former PSV coach whose name escapes me now, who built up this card index of penalty takers and where they usually put the ball. And Van Breukelen, he told Van Breukelen ahead of the European Cup final when PSV won about the guys, and he saved the last penalty. And apparently before this game, Van Breukelen rang him and asked him if he faced a penalty. I can't remember who took it now, forgive me. But Van Breukelen says he was taxed a penalty, which way did he put it? And the guy told him. And yeah. He watched the penalty save. He's almost waiting for the ball.
Yeah, this is one of the early stories about data analysis, isn't it? And performance analysis. What I find really interesting about that story, I'm teaching performance analysis at the moment, and what I find really interesting about that story is the way that the player takes on the data analysis too. Because after that coach leaves him, because he wasn't working with that coach at the
correct.
Time.
Correct.
After the coach leaves him, he keeps his own data cards and he builds up his own collection. It's almost like collecting football cards for fans. But yeah, it gives you that confidence when you're then against that person and you can predict more accurately what they're going to do. Still got to have the confidence to go with the card because they could change their mind. But yeah, it was a significant thing, wasn't it? That was the final, right? And they were already...
Sorry, forgive me, yes. I skipped again, didn't I? Sorry, forgive
that's
me.
Fine,
I'm on to the final. Yeah, so let's go to the final. I mean, obviously, and David Grimm's book, he mentions that after the celebrations there, the Dutch royal family are there and in the hotel, and it's almost like they had the celebration ahead of the getting to the final. But the final would not be after the Lord Mayor's show sort of performance. And obviously, you know, it was probably the two best teams in the tournament playing in the final. I mean, it's quite often you get, you know, I mean, like I said, in 1974, the Dutch playing Poland would have been a great World Cup final, but that didn't happen. But in this tournament, it was the two best teams in the tournament.
Yeah, I think the two best coaches as well.
Definitely.
You know, and they really are big beasts of coaching, these two. So one of the things I wanted to quickly talk about was this is Mikkel's last major achievement in a long career. Goes on to coach at Bayer Leverkusen and gets his worst win percentage ever in his whole career. I think he comes back to coach the Netherlands for one more time. But this is his final major achievement. This probably secured Mikkel's FIFA Coach of the Century Award. And if I talk about a counter-narrative for a bit, if the Soviets had won, that crown would have probably been Lobanovsky's, which is a really interesting one.
It's a great point, David. It's absolutely a great point. Yeah, there were two absolute legendary coaches that had so much success, not only success in the field, but also
influential.
The way revolutionized the way the game was played and brought success because of that rather than just because they had the best players.
Yeah, absolutely. They're kind of coaches who are catalysts, right? They make things happen, yeah.
Yeah, so let's talk about the final. So, I mean, obviously, we'll go on to the Van Basten goal in a bit, but because of that celebration of the second goal, the first goal is often cast into the shadows. And yet, I mean, it was a wonderful header to put the Dutch ahead.
Yeah, it's funny actually, reflecting upon it, I think, did it come from a cross? Because I think the second one is from an overhit cross.
Yeah, I think the corner goes too far and then it's crossed back in, it's header out and it's played back in and a header across.
So I think both goals could be as a result of an overhit cross. Because I think from memory, Van Basten is moving backwards to take the header.
Oh, yeah.
He realises he can't get it on target, so he heads it cleverly back across the goal. And all the defenders have been sucked in. And Hullet with a bullet goes from the six-yard area, a really powerful header. But it's really interesting, this thing about the overhit cross, because it's Arnold Muren who sets it up for the second goal. But it's really overhit. And that second goal is so incredible because Van Basten's almost looking at it over his shoulder. He's retreating towards the right-hand edge of the area. But as he does that, he's getting closer and closer towards the goal line. And, you know, he said that he didn't have anything else to do in the end. He was too tired to do anything else, so he just lashed out at it. But you know, the ball, even after he struck it, it doesn't fire into the goal. It fires over the goalkeeper into the top corner and the side netting. It's just an incredible goal.
Yeah, it absolutely is. I mean, I just remember it's down memory lane. When we were very much younger, I was playing football with a friend and he was playing on the right and obviously goal. And his cross came over to it and he just swung his foot at it. His left foot, but he swung his right foot at it and just absolutely screamed past me. I said, Andy, where's that come from? He said, I couldn't be bothered to go and fetch it. he predicted Van Basten's goal. Andrew Wall, take a bow. But yeah, I mean, it was great. But just go back to Hullet's header. I mean, it's a cross comes over, and he's hit back, and all the players are coming out. The defenders are coming out because things offside, and Hullet goes in. And the power on that, you set the bullet, and, you know, Desaev, it didn't go either side of it. It went straight above him. He just couldn't get his hands in. It was probably as well he didn't because he probably took his hands in the back of the net. But the image of the dreadlocks flying as he headed the ball is like extra power. Absolutely. No, nobody's saving that. You put five goalkeepers in and nobody's saving that, are they?
And it wasn't even a classic attacking header because you're taught to head the ball down.
Correct.
But he just went straight through it, yeah.
Yeah, he probably thought, well, Darren, oh, you ain't stopping this tiger, no matter where you are. So yeah, let's go Van Basten's goal, because this is great. Let's have a little just chat about Van Basten's goal. Maybe we touched on it earlier. And the ball that, as you said, was over across from Muir, and his ball played to Muir, and I think he hit his first time with his left foot. It's terrible cross. It's absolutely atrocious cross. As you say, Van Basten's backing away. And Desailly is, you know, certainly one of the best top goalkeepers in Europe at the time. And and as he sort of, you know, lashes the ball, Desailly is like somebody who took one on the chin from Mike Tyson, staggering about.
Yeah, it's almost like he deals a double knockout blow here, because the goalkeeper staggers around as if he's been hit, as you say. But then Rinus Michels as well looks completely shocked. Oh. He's got his head in his hands. He just can't believe what he's seen. So it was shocking to everyone, shockingly good.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've only ever seen a coach do coached this twice. The other time was when Bobby Robson was managing Barcelona, and Ronaldo, the real Ronaldo, the proper Ronaldo, scored the goal running from the halfway line against Compostela, I think it was, in northern Spain. And Robson went like that on top of his head, I can't believe that. And Michels was exactly the same. And apparently before the final, the players had bought, it was going to be Michels' last game, whatever happened. And the players had bought Michels a watch. And he said, "You've got to win the game, otherwise I'm giving you the watch back." And he grasps the watch. You don't see it very often, but if you don't know, you'll see it on some of the clips. He actually grasps the watch, which I think is an emotional moment.
But that's a lovely story. I knew the story about him giving the watch, and he said he'd give it back if they lost. Well, I've never seen the bit about grasping the watch. That's lovely.
I think it's a still I've seen, and I think it's on his left wrist, and he just holds up like that's much to say to the players. I'm keeping the watch now. You know, I mean, it's a great sort of moment. But you know, we said about, you know, the Dutch previously and since haven't won a trophy. You know, you have to wonder why, because of all the great players they've had. And, you know, I always say about the significance. So, do you remember where you were when you saw this?
Not sure where I saw it, but I was a young PE teacher starting out my career in the East End of London. And I was someone whose first World Cup final that I watched was 1974. So I was really invested in the tournament, and I was really invested in the story that unfolded, because I'd been there, like Van Breukelen, 14 years before. And it felt like a really redemptive narrative that had just kind of come round again. Really lovely.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember so well. I was at home, and, you know, being a massive fan of Dutch football, and, you know, carrying the torch in 1974, it was a great moment. So, you know, and they'd won the tournament, beaten a great Soviet Union team, beat Germany in the semi-final as well. Do you think they want to go on, and they're going to do something great now? They've got the World Cup coming up in 2 years' time. Michels is gone, but Bean Hacker comes in to take over. Although I think the players wanted Cruyff at the time to take over. I think they had I remember talking to a Dutch journalist when I was writing one of my Dutch books, that they had at the airport to Schiphol before they were flying there to play a qualifying game. They had a vote, and the players voted for Cruyff, but the Dutch FA, the KNVB, gave it to Beenhakker. I think it was Michels who persuaded them to take Beenhakker. But anyway, Beenhakker wasn't the right guy at the right time. Great coach, but caused ructions, as always in the Dutch team, especially when they're doing well. Somebody's going to turn the table over, and this was the thing.
I was going to say, you know, the Dutch are our own worst enemies in terms of micro-politics, and there's a lot of friction between Cruyff and Michels in the run-up to this tournament. And, you know, Cruyff wanted him to play three forwards, and Michels was playing two forwards, and it became a bit abrasive. Somebody said about to Michels what Cruyff had done with Ajax, you know, in the Eredivisie, and he said, you know, that's nothing. that's easy to win there. So they started to be a bit abrasive with each other. And that's the significance of this now is that this brings a lot of belief to the Dutch nation that they won't necessarily fall at the last footballing hurdle. But they've done so since again in 2010 when somebody labelled how they played total thuggery.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Yeah, talk about playing with clogs on. I mean, they're playing with clogs on. And yeah, so, I mean, I remember Cruyff, I think I wrote in the book, a Dutch book about it, that he said, you know, they weren't the Dutch team. Spanish were far more Dutch than the Dutch team were in that World Cup final, and in fact, throughout the tournament. But yeah, so, you know, the significance of these memories are always a nice little thing to ponder. great team going forward, although they had players who were sort of quite in the veteran stage, like Murin was knocking on a bit then, obviously, as well.
He was 37, and like most of the other players are sort of 26. It's quite a gap. But it's a lovely romantic thing about him being there, because he's almost a link to Mikkel's great Ajax team. Because I know Mikkel's left, and then they recruited Murin just afterwards. But, you know, he was there in that early 70s Ajax team. And as I understand it, before this Euros, he'd only got 17 caps for the Netherlands, and then Mikkels brings him back in. And it's a lovely kind of story to have him there, having been part of that first iteration of Total Football.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously, his brother Jerry was there a few years before that. But I think Mikkels had gone by the time he came on board, but he might have been there anyway. But it's interesting you mentioned about we're going to chat on for a bit, David. I mean, who cares about the time? As long as you're okay for time. I remember another European Championship when it was Belgium. They brought back a guy called Van Moer, who I think was about 36, 37, hadn't played for international football for a few years. And he had a wonderful tournament, and Belgium got to the final and lost to Germany. I think Horst Rubesch scored the winner. So sometimes, you know, having that guy who's perhaps knows it's his last hurrah and ain't got nothing to lose, perhaps there's a little bit of a benefit in that that's, you know, it's not there with players who are a bit more concerned about their future.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, we talked before we came on here, I've got my Inter Milan shirt on from when they won under Mourinho, and that was an ageing team, and it was their last hurrah at winning the European Cup, and they did. It's almost like you've got nothing to lose, isn't it, when you're at that stage of your career, but you've got all that experience to draw upon. And when you've got a young team, and they were a young team that won this Euro 88, you need a foil, you need that old head, the bit of experience, and almost the cultural kudos that he's got of having played for that great Ajax team in the past. It's almost part of the storied aspect of this kind of narrative we're talking about. So talking about memorable players quickly, because I don't think maybe we've emphasised it. Call it Van Basten, Rijkaard, Koeman. Now, Rijkaard and Koeman, Ron Koeman at the back, they were incredible defenders who could play out from the back. You know, they were capable of finding the incisive passes out from there. They were really important, those two players. But you had some real workhorses as well. Yeah, Wouters in midfield, real workhorse, real water carrier type role. So really nice team when you look back. Lots of nice memories. I don't think they were Total Football. I think they were very pragmatic, as I said. But they closed it out, and they closed it out in style. And Hullet had a bit of charisma. I think it's important to say, I think I'm right in saying this, that Hullet was the first and only black captain to lift the Euro trophy. And at the time he did it, he was the current European Footballer of the Year as well.
Yeah, good stat. Yeah. It's just about Koeman. It might not have been this season before the tournament. It was round about that. He played as a libero for PSV, and I think he was second top scorer in the Eredivisie. And we took penalties and free kicks as well. But that's a libero. That's pretty impressive. But yeah, I mean, okay. So just going to dip forward again and going what happened next, as it were. The 1990 World Cup, where the Dutch were probably going in as certainly one of the favourites, if not the favourites. It all fell apart, didn't it?
I remember, again, the micro-politics, and I think Hullet was involved in that, right? And, you know, they've got this capacity to implode, haven't they, at the last minute? And they seem to be their own worst enemies at certain times. It's almost like they're better off going in not being favourites.
Yeah, right. You're right. Absolutely right. And I mean, obviously, in 1974, when they went to play the World into the World Cup, they hadn't qualified for a World Cup since 1938, I think, and they played two World Cup games previously and lost them both. And I remember the quote in David Winner's book that says they had a World Cup record equivalent to that of Luxembourg when they went into the 1974 tournament. But yeah, just interesting point about, you know, the sort of dispute between Mikkels and Cruyff. And so sad that these things happen, but they do. And Mikkels went to work for the KNVB, and he wrote a pamphlet, a coaching manual almost. It's called, I'm thinking my Dutch isn't right, but it's called the Zeister Vista or something. But Zeister is where the KNVB are based. It's called the View from Zeister, in English. And he advocated building what they called Cruyff Courts. So these were basically Cruyff and that generation. These happened to so many players, but a lot of great Brazilian team, the same thing. And I remember Jimmy Johnson saying about the Celtic team when the European Cup 67. They grew up playing on the streets, and the ball doesn't run true, like the billiard table pitches we have today. And you got to, it tests your skill. You have to hone your skill. And he had this thing about building these Cruyff courts and across the country to make players. Because of your sort of profession, perhaps something you could comment on.
Well, Cruyff himself obviously had his own foundation, and he ended up doing that, didn't he? He ended up building those sports courts. He was a great believer in people learning football on the streets, learning in unstructured play. I remember a story, somebody asked Cruyff about his balance and how he had the balance he had. And he said he used to play on concrete and gravel surfaces and you didn't want to fall over on them. So you learned how to keep your feet, etc. The danger we've got in the modern era is, do we make training so formal and do we make it so constrained that we coach creativity out of people? And that is the danger. And the trouble is, we're health and safety obsessed and we don't want people to play on surfaces where they might fall over and cut themselves or something. But you've got to have a bit of danger. You've got to have a bit of risk to give you the reward of not doing it. So, you know, I come from a generation where, you know, your mum and dad had to come out and try and find you as dusk came down because you needed to eat something. But kids don't spend as long on the streets now or in the parks, and maybe there's not as many park areas for them to go to. Kids need the opportunity for unstructured play. And I'm including big kids like me. We go and play walking football every now and then. And so play is underutilized, and people learning in situ on the streets, what was it? Pelé with an orange, wasn't it? It is very valuable, but also very difficult for kids to get now. There aren't the spaces. They're encouraged to do organized training early on, maybe too early on. There's a wonderful article actually about Erling Haaland and his development. It's a journal article and it's called As Many as Possible for as Long as Possible. And what it is, it means don't discard people from the academy route. Keep them in, let them play together and see what emerges. And this is a club that he was involved in Norway. I can't remember the name of the club, but the club had the same players who went through together all those years. They enjoyed it. They got some people who went into the pro game, not only Haaland, but they also had people who'd enjoyed the whole experience. And it's a wonderful picture of a club that allows the players every now and then to go, no, nothing planned today. You organise what you want to do, kids. And you know, I remember in that article, one time the players come off and they got a problem on the pitch with a particular player or whatever. And they asked the coach what to do. And the coach says, no, I want you to go and work out what to do. And there's that hands-off element where people learn by themselves that I think we're not using as much now.
I'm into that, David. I'm into that. So, you know, people often use the phrase, you know, football is a blood battery hemisphere. They're sort of kept in metaphorical cage, coaching cages almost. And, you know, yeah. Just one little point you said about Cruyff's balance. I was massively fortunate to have an interview with Ruud Krol when I was writing the Dutch Masters book. And he told me that Cruyff, he always resembled a ballet dancer. Because he's got that, not only the balance, but that poise, that elegance about him as well. So, yeah. David, I've had a bit of fantastic chat about the Dutch, and particularly 88 when they won it. So I'm going to just look forward a bit now to the Euros. Do you think the Euros are as big as the World Cup or becoming that way?
Well, the World Cup's got a longer history. It's more prestigious. It's got a larger global audience. But the Euros were previously much smaller than the World Cups, of course. But now they've got some parity in terms of size, although the Euros are still smaller, and I understand that the World Cup amount of teams is due to expand again. The Euros could be argued to be more competitive, though, as there are less meaningless one-sided games, and the Euro region's probably the best in terms of the quality of teams on the planet. But in the latter knockout stages of both tournaments, the intensity and competitiveness is probably fairly similar, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more, David. So if I asked you for one or two things that you're perhaps most looking forward to in the upcoming European Championship, what would you say?
Strangely, I'm going to say England. England entering a major international tournament as favourites for the first time ever. I don't think we've been favourites before for any World Cup or Euros. It'll be really interesting to see if that label as being favourites will lift them confidence-wise or will hamper them with a weight of expectation. Just going to be curious, really, for me, you know, does that lift or does that depress? Is it a performance lift or a performance threat? It is the interesting thing that strikes me. So I'll be looking forward to seeing that. I'm looking forward to seeing the sublime talent of Jude Bellingham on the big stage. I think if he can replicate club form at Real Madrid, he could and perhaps should be one of the stars of the tournament. But I sincerely hope he doesn't have to do too much of the heavy lifting on his own for England. I'm looking for from England a shared responsibility and a greater collective attacking intent, particularly from the manager as well. As ever, England need to find a creative spark to ignite their full potential as favourites. That cutting edge was largely absent against Brazil recently, for instance. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity as favourites, but are we technically and tactically good enough to win it? We will see.
I mean, it's a great point about Jude Bellingham. I mean, I'm supporting over here because I see him play for Real Madrid every week. For a guy, and you have to remember, how this isn't a 26, 27, you know, case-hardened guy who's been playing top international football or top club football for 10 years. I mean, he's a kid. I mean, a young kid at that. And when he plays him play for Real Madrid, he bosses games. I mean, he just demands to organise the game. He's, I mean, a fantastic talent. And, you know, you want to believe, you want to hope, you want to sort of almost pray that this could be his coming out party. You know, in Spain, he's recognised as, you know, certainly one of the best teams, one of the best players in the league and perhaps across Europe. But perhaps this could be his tournament where he convinces the rest of Europe that that's the case. Fingers crossed, yeah.
Really exciting talent. It's really nice to see that quality in the England side. What I really like about him as well, he seems like a well-rounded person. There's a lovely clip that I saw where he's on the bench and there's a little ball boy who's shivering in the cold and he takes his top off and gives it to the ball boy. You know, and they're very small things, but, you know, what do they say in the All Blacks in rugby? They say better people make better All Blacks. You know, if you've got somebody who's a good person as well, then maybe they can help to express their own talent and not self-sabotage, like we talked a little bit about the Dutch at the tournament.
Perhaps it may help that, you know, this guy came through Birmingham City. I mean, he didn't come through Man City, Liverpool, Arsenal, top club. He came from Birmingham City and then went to Dortmund, who had this great reputation for getting players and developing players before moving them on. And, you know, certainly it's worked well for Bellingham. So, yeah, fingers crossed. Dave, I want to say massive thanks for coming on board. I mean, and choosing my favourite 1988 European Championship and when the Dutch got over the line for the first and only time in their lives. And orange was the colour. That completes our stroll down memory lane. I'll say massive thanks to David for sharing his thoughts. Catch us again next time when I'll be chatting with another member of the TFT team about their recollection of the European Championships. But for now, thanks and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.